The nation's biggest pension firm wants to give less money to Wall Street. Europe's biggest airline wants you to shop local. And hey, got half a million bucks? Because I got a green card to sell you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, June 8th. Thank you for joining us. Wall Street has a lot of good reasons to care about retired workers. That's because investment managers at private equity and hedge funds rack up big-time fees handling money for the firms that run our pensions and retirement plans. CalPERS is the biggest. It manages some $300 billion of California pension money, which means it gives a lot of business to Wall Street. But today, CalPERS said it's changing the game. It's going to cut the number of money managers it uses in half. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on what this could mean for Wall Street and, more importantly, for your life savings.
CalPERS believes it has way too many people managing its money, charging way too much. Jean-Pierre Aubry is with the Center for Retirement Research, where he looks closely at public pension funds.
It's among the highest, so it's really one of the top 10 in terms of the fees it pays compared to the other largest plans in the nation.
These funds have enough trouble just finding enough money to pay retirees, so they're all under pressure to cut expenses. It's not that CalPERS is dropping Wall Street to go its own way. It's more about buying in bulk, explains University of Virginia economics professor Lior Friedberg.
They're going to then concentrate a bigger share of their total funds with a smaller group of managers.
CalPERS wants to more easily track performance and drive a harder bargain on those fees. Some on Wall Street could make more money. Others will lose out. And CalPERS is just the beginning, says Berkeley's Stephen Davidoff Solomon.
CalPERS is the 800-pound gorilla of pension funds.
With heft comes influence. Other pension funds could follow suit, forcing Wall Street investment managers to fight harder for business by slashing fees. The CalPERS fight is also a reminder to regular folks like us, with 401ks and other human-size investments. Take a close look at the fees you pay, or they could devour your savings.
The lesson here is pretty simple. It's keep your eye on the ball. Don't have too many funds. Make sure you know what you're getting out of your investments.
Even if you don't have CalPERS $300 billion to work with, you could still play it smart with what you've got. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
One big airline is also reconsidering its pricing structure. As the busy summer travel season starts up, Germany-based Lufthansa wants you to buy your plane tickets directly from them. Starting September 1st, Europe's leading airline is adding a toll to price comparison sites. If you book on a site like Orbitz or Expedia, sites that use computerized reservation networks, Lufthansa will charge an extra 16 euros, or about $18. The airline says the move is designed to bring in more money, but of course that's at a cost to travelers. Marketplace's Gigi Duban reports.
Price comparison sites almost always book at the lowest fare. That's good for consumers, but bad for airlines, because the fees airlines pay to these sites are the same no matter what a ticket costs. Robert Mann is an airline industry analyst.
They are, on a percentage-wise basis, the highest distribution costs as a percentage of revenue that an airline would ever experience.
Lufthansa says using the online booking system costs it in the three-digit million euro range. By imposing this surcharge, Lufthansa says it could make more money if it drives customers to book directly. Paul Rudin is Executive Vice President for Legal and Industry Affairs for the American Society of Travel Agents. He says Lufthansa will ultimately lose bargain-minded customers.
If their idea is that consumers will completely abandon all alternatives and book only directly with Lufthansa, then I think they're dreaming.
Carl Moore teaches at McGill University and follows the airline industry. He says this is about control. By driving travelers to book through them directly, the airline can showcase more options, options that cost extra and that wouldn't show up on a comparison booking site like Orbitz. This money-making strategy is called unbundling.
So instead of getting, you know, a meal with your flight and a particular seat and this sort of thing, is that if you want to have a particular seat, an aisle seat, for example, or have a meal, you pay extra for it.
That's why Rudin says this tactic might work for Lufthansa at the expense of consumers. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not much good news for airlines or anyone. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Apple's 2015 Worldwide Developers Conference kicked off today in San Francisco. The conference hosts developers for a preview of what's to come in software for Apple products, but it's also often a place for Apple to announce new products and initiatives. So today, Apple CEO Tim Cook gave a keynote address where he announced, among other things, a new music streaming and internet radio service, Apple Music, coming later this month. But can Apple use its captive audience to make Apple Music a success? Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, and he is at the event. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Molly. How are you?
I'm great. I think this is the first time I've ever interviewed you.
I know.
So, Ben, the big announcement, it happened, no surprise. Tell me about Apple Music.
Okay, well, Apple Music is a thing that is very similar to many other services out there already, Molly. You know of Spotify, you know of Pandora, you know of Google Music. Apple Music has now finally entered the streaming music game here. And the company is basically talking about a couple of different ways that this service will function. One is Beats One, which is this sort of 24/7 streaming radio service that is put together by DJs in LA, New York, and London. Another is a streaming service that you would use through Apple called Apple Music, and you would pay $9.99 for one account or $14.99 to have a kind of family account that up to six people could share. And then another function here is that artists can actually share content directly with their fans by uploading social media posts and stuff like that directly through Apple Music to their fans.
But it is certainly, I mean, you raised the very good point that it's a crowded field. There are a lot of streaming services already. What was your read on kind of the reaction of the crowd?
It wasn't a surprise, Molly. I mean, people were surprised maybe a little bit to see Drake walk out on stage. That probably got the biggest reaction of the day as far as that announcement was concerned. The thing that we have to remember, Molly, is, you know, Apple has 800 million credit card data sets. It has devices in millions of hands of people all over the world. And I think that this is Apple's play to introduce streaming music to the mainstream. Now, you know, when Apple first announced iTunes and first started bringing digital music to the mainstream, a lot of people didn't know about it. I mean, people who weren't on Napster or doing other similar things didn't know a lot about what it was to download and listen to MP3s. Now, many years later, I think the company probably hopes to do the same thing, really introduce this to the mainstream and get people all over the world who are using Apple devices to use Apple Music.
So Apple Music, obviously the big announcement. Was there any other headline, anything that jumped out at you as really interesting?
Actually, one of the other really interesting things is a sort of evolution of Apple Pay. You know, Apple Pay is this payment system that works on the watch and on the phone, and it works with Apple's Passbook, which is this place where you store all your credit cards and other sort of sensitive information. Now Passbook is being changed to Apple Wallet, and all of this is going to work with new store partners, and it's going to work in some interesting ways, Molly, in order to give users rewards when they go up to buy things at the counter at maybe Starbucks or maybe a retailer. Instead of you having to figure out which card to pull out to get you the best rewards, supposedly Apple Pay, with the help from Apple Wallet, will actually do that for you automatically, which could be, you know, an added layer of convenience for this service.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, and he is at WWDC in San Francisco. Thanks a lot, Ben.
Yeah, thank you, Molly.
Here's some kind of surprising news. It turns out green cards are for sale. Some people wait in line for as long as 10 years to get a green card to come to the U.S. But for about $500,000, wealthy foreigners can jump to the front of that line. That $500,000 has to be invested in a project that creates jobs in America. So many real estate developers are using this federal program to fund giant new buildings. Most of the people applying for these green cards are from China. It's a controversial program that's due for renewal later this year. Julie Satow reports.
Lou Saviano is standing next to his job site in Midtown Manhattan. Saviano's worked on dozens of construction projects across the city, but he says this apartment building is different.
In 28 years of surveying, this is one of the craziest buildings I've ever done.
Behind Saviano looms a massive 31-story, four-sided pyramid. But what makes it more unusual than just its shape is the fact that it's helping 400 Chinese nationals get their green cards.
No. Yeah? I didn't know that. Why would that happen?
Because each one of them invested $500,000 in the building, and each of these investments created at least 10 jobs. Under the federal EB-5 visa program, they can get their legal residency in as little as 22 months.
You know, this is a program that gets low-interest funds for U.S. companies.
That's Clem Turner. He's a lawyer at Homeyer & Law, and he puts together these kind of deals.
It gets Americans who are unemployed back to work, and it gets immigrants who want to pursue the American dream. It doesn't actually get them a green card. It gets them to the front of the line for the green card process.
Federal immigration still vets the investors, but the process is speeded up.
It's like a fast pass at Disneyland. You're not circumventing, but a 10-year process is becoming 1 year.
The program isn't new. It started in 1990, but it wasn't until the financial crisis, when developers couldn't get bank loans, that the program became popular. And in recent years, its use has exploded. For the first time ever last year, the 10,000 visas allotted to the program were oversubscribed. That happened again this year. It's generated billions of dollars in investment, and states across the country use it. California tops the list, followed closely by New York.
I really think this is a good program.
Victor Chow works with F&T Group, a large developer in nearby Queens. It's building a huge project with the Hyatt Hotel and dozens of offices, shops, and apartments. It's partly funded by 40 Chinese investors.
I think that's definitely going to help the U.S. economy. I see positive side. More positive side than the negative.
Chow spent a year finding his investors and vetting their credentials.
I talk to them. I try to check where they come from. I work with their CPA. I see their source of funding.
But despite these efforts, he still has doubts.
I cannot say they 100% they're legitimate, but I think we do our job.
Analysts who've tried studying the program say there's a lack of transparency. It's tough, for example, to know if the number of jobs promised are actually created. Even the cheerleaders of the program, like Clem Turner, agree that more scrutiny is needed.
More oversight is never a bad thing, given the stories that have come out about people that have exploited this program.
For example, a Chicago developer defrauded 290 Chinese investors out of $160 million. But changes could be coming. In September, parts of the program are set to expire, and Congress is likely to take a closer look. Oversight might be improved, the number of visas could be expanded, and the price for that $500,000 green card may go up. In New York, I'm Julie Satow for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, I've always been fascinated by the idea of augmenting humans, of giving us superpowers, if you will.
A former Microsoft engineer's novel on improving humans with technology. But first, let's do the numbers. Numbers are down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 82 points, 0.4%, to end at 17,766. The NASDAQ gave up 46 points, 0.9%, to close at 5021. The S&P 500 lost 13 points, 0.2%, to finish at 2079. Airline stocks hit a little turbulence despite a positive report on the industry's prospects for the year. JetBlue led the field lower, dropping 7%. American Airlines fell nearly 4.5%. Southwest Airlines dropped more than 2.75%. And United Continental lost more than 4%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.38%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its job openings and labor turnover survey for April. The Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for April. And composer Cole Porter was born on June 9, 1891. How de lovely. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. The BBC, Britain's state-owned broadcasting organization, is one of the biggest media corporations in the world. Even Marketplace has a relationship with them. And the way the BBC gets its money is that every citizen in Britain has to pay for a license to watch TV. If you don't pay the license fee, you can be fined and even jailed. That generates billions of dollars to fund the BBC's network, but not everyone loves it. In fact, there's now a new government in power in the UK, and it has the BBC license fee square in its sights. Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains.
The BBC could almost feature in one of its own brilliant natural history shows. It is a very unusual beast.
This animal was as big as a rhino. It had a large hairy crest running down its spine and a formidable set of teeth.
The beeb, as it's commonly called, is an extraordinary and hungry creature, consuming more than $5 billion of public money a year. It's widely praised for the overall excellence of its output, but not everyone's happy about how the beeb gets its cash.
It's daft, it's totally out of date. It stems from the time when the BBC was a monopoly broadcaster.
Eamon Butler of the free market Adam Smith Institute objects to the licence fee. The system forces everyone who owns a TV set to pay $220 a year to fund the BBC.
I own a television, but I very rarely watch the BBC because I've got about 200 other channels now to choose from. So why should I be forced to pay for a network which I don't actually look at when I've got so much other choice?
Critics of the licence fee system say that it leads the BBC, this great liberal institution, into punitive, even Orwellian territory.
Your town, your street, your home, it's all in our database.
When the Bee broadcast this rather sinister warning a few years ago, it caused outrage in some quarters. The message, it's a criminal offence to watch TV without buying a licence.
And impossible to hide if you don't. It's all in the database.
Collecting the licence fee can be messy. Last year, 155,000 people were fined for non-payment. 50 of them went to jail for then failing to pay the fine. In this poor part of East London, there's no shortage of people who begrudge buying the licence. Among them, single mothers Jasmine Stone and Jamila Nanyonga.
It's wrong. Why are people being criminalised for being essentially poor? People being put in prison for not having enough money. If somebody wants to have a TV in their home, they should be able to have a TV without having to fork out for a TV licence.
If you bought your own TV in your own money, why should you pay for the TV licence? What's the whole point? And then for you to go to prison if you don't pay it, that's just crazy.
The new British government says it wants to decriminalise non-payment of the licence fee to make it a civil matter, like the non-payment of a telephone bill. But, says opposition culture spokesman Chris Bryant, that would mean that enforcing the fee would cost more than the revenue it would raise. Fewer people would pay it.
There's a danger that you just smash a great big £200 million hole, which is the same as the cost of all children's broadcasting by the BBC. You'll smash that, a £200 million hole in the BBC's finances without having thought how to make that up from any other source.
Hardly anyone is calling for commercials on the BBC, and there is still a lot of support for a publicly funded state-owned broadcaster.
Newsround, Newsnight, I play a website, Tony Arthur.
This song, I'm Proud of the BBC, has become something of a hit on YouTube.
I'm proud of the BBC, it's part of you and it's part of me.
Ben Fenton, a media analyst, says he speaks for most Brits when he enthuses about the Beeb.
It produces some astonishingly good television, some very, very good radio, and its website is something I probably refer to several times a day. So, yeah, I'm a consumer. I like the product. I'm happy to pay for it.
But many are not. 1,000 British households a day are opting out of the licence fee, claiming they no longer have a TV set and get their news and entertainment over the internet. The Beeb may need to find new ways to raise its revenue. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Artificial intelligence, Wi-Fi connected brains, and a future where the government is trying to deal with humans who are using technology to become a little more than human. That's the topic of a new book called Apex. It's book 3 in the Nexus trilogy. The story is set 20 years in the future and tells a tale of a world far too connected by technology that mostly exists today. Ramez Nam is a technologist, futurist, and former Microsoft developer. He's the author of the Nexus trilogy, and he joins us now. Ramez, thanks for being here.
Hi, Molly. Great to be here.
So in 2012, you released Nexus, which was your first book about this fictional connected world of the future. You just concluded with Apex. And I know that so much of this is based on real science and your previous career. How did your career working, especially with artificial intelligence, start to inspire this series?
Well, I've always been fascinated by the idea of augmenting humans, of giving us superpowers, if you will. And when I wrote my first nonfiction book, I did a lot of research into that. And the technology that fascinated me the most was this idea of putting implants in the human brain, which is being done for people who are paralyzed or blind or deaf. And that technology was just so much more advanced than I thought. And as a computer guy, it made sense to me. And when I started writing fiction, it was an easy technology to plug in.
Right. So in the book, you write about this experimental drug that actually links people's minds together so that they can share experiences. But what could possibly go wrong here?
Yeah. So Nexus, the eponymous drug, is sort of a technology that gets into your brain and links people's minds together by Wi-Fi. And everything you can imagine can go wrong, from software crashes in your brain to hackers to sort of the equivalent of the NSA wanting to snoop in on your thoughts.
But this is, like you said, this is based on real technology. I mean, how, as in mind-to-mind connections might be possible, might already be happening?
We've done it in a very, very crude way today. I'm here near the campus of the University of Washington in Seattle, and researchers here last year played a video game together with their minds linked. One person could see the screen but didn't have a keyboard, and the other person had the keyboard but couldn't see the screen. And the first researcher across campus actually controlled the hand of the one who had the keyboard. People have emailed thoughts back and forth between humans. We've sent video into the human brain. We've let paralyzed people use brain implants to control robot arms. So it's happening, though it's very, very crude right now.
Well, so your whole trilogy really explores the ethics behind using tech to kind of create a different class of humans. So as technology becomes more advanced, we start to integrate it into our lives. Do you think there will be a lot of objections over how it's being used?
There will be. You know, when we had in vitro fertilization invented about 30 years ago, the cover of Time magazine was test tube babies, and we thought this was deeply unnatural. Today, we have Chinese scientists a month ago announced that they had used a gene editing technology called CRISPR to edit human embryos. And that causes a similar sort of freak out in society to IVF and test tube babies. But 30 years on, no one talks about test tube babies. People don't even say in vitro fertilization. They just say, oh, we had some trouble getting pregnant, went to the doctor, and now we have twins.
So is there a line, do you think, between what we can do scientifically and what we should do?
I think there is. But mostly people choose to do these things for their betterment or their kids. If somebody's trying to do it to really hurt someone else, make that illegal. But let people make smart choices for themselves.
All right. So bring on the augmentation.
I think so. Let's do it.
I'm ready. Ramez Nam is the author of Apex, recently released in stores, and the third book in the Nexus trilogy. Ramez, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Molly.
This final note, who says Netflix doesn't have any good movies? After focusing on original TV and shows that you can binge watch, the streaming service has landed its biggest movie debut yet. Brad Pitt's new movie, War Machine, will debut on Netflix at the same time it lands in theaters. Reports say Netflix spent a cool $30 million to get the film, and to keep annoying theater owners, of course. War Machine is a satirical comedy that stars Pitt as a general who leads the American war effort in Afghanistan. It's due out next year. Now, Netflix has announced a couple other movie debuts, but we all know that once you get Brad Pitt, you're cooking with gas. All right, that's it. That's the show. Today, the Dow fell 82 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ gave up 46 points, 0.9%. And the S&P 500 lost 13 points, or 0.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Austin Cross, Robert Garova, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Molly Wood, and I hope you liked it, because I'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.